Give this talk, so yeah, the title is Time Like Entanglement in the Quantum Vacuum. So I'll try to convince you that it makes sense to talk about entanglement for time-like separated regions as opposed to ordinarily the way we think of entanglement is at a particular time. If I have a state, then it makes sense to say the state is non-separable and therefore entangled. But this also works through time. So the way I'll do it is first I'll just remind you of how we do it in the case of space-like entanglement in the quantum vacuum. And by quantum vacuum, I mean the Minkowski vacuum. And then I'll use a symmetry argument to basically say that the same thing applies in this case as well. So ordinarily, this is introduced in the context of the Unruh effect, things like that. And so I will I'll show you that a similar effect, a symmetrical effect, occurs between the future and the past, actually just in the future or the past. I'll talk about how time-like entanglement is related to ordinary entanglement by showing that you can extract it and convert one into the other. And then I'll talk about, do some hand-waving and talk about possible applications, that kind of stuff. Okay, so let's start out with the space-like case. So the idea is that all fields are going to satisfy this commutation relation between the left and the right region of Minkowski space. And therefore, the fields in those regions can be regarded as independent subsystems. And therefore, when I specify a state, it makes sense to discuss the possibility of entanglement. And by entanglement, I just mean the ordinary meaning of non-separable. So how are we going to do this? Well, what I'll do is I'll define coordinates in left and right and define modes in there in each one that are independent from each other and express the quantum field as a express the vacuum in terms of those modes, so I can talk about left and right separately. Because ordinarily the plane waves in Minkowski space cover all of space-time, so it's difficult to, you can't really separate them into the left and the right components. So we need separate modes for that. So this is how we do it. This is standard. You can look it up in Brown and Davies, for example. So this is called this region is called the Rindler wedge. And these are the Rindler coordinates. So in this case, tau is the time-like coordinate, and epsilon is a space-like coordinate. And if I move along tau, if I just evolve along tau for a fixed epsilon, that takes me along a hyperbolic trajectory, an accelerated trajectory. And if I want to define modes in these coordinate systems, this is what the wave equation looks like. And this is in 1 plus 1 dimensional space-time, so everything kind of simplifies a lot. And here's the mode solutions. We can expand them. And they look like plane waves, but they're plane waves in these Rindler coordinates. So the quantization procedure is completely analogous to that of all of space-time if you just quantize each one independently. But then how do we talk about entanglement? Okay, so here's those modes. Oh, by the way, we're looking at only left-moving modes because in 1 plus 1 dimension, it's easy to separate the left-moving sector from the right-moving sector. Just simplifies the math a lot just to talk about one, so that's all I'll do here. Let's see. Okay, yeah. So here's the modes that I mentioned before. Here's your ordinary Minkowski space plane waves. And this V is the usual light cone coordinate. And V is related to this chi here in the Rindler modes in this particular way, exponentially related. And I can expand these Rindler modes in terms of these Minkowski space plane waves, because the plane waves are defined over all space-time. And so, therefore, I should be able to write one set of modes in terms of the other. And so that's what this is. This just tells me that I can form some superposition of those plane waves and get a Rindler mode. Now, these alphas and betas are called the Bogolubov coefficients for that expansion. The bar is just differentiates the right Rindler coordinates from the left Rindler coordinates. These bars aren't complex conjugate or anything. They're just left moving. They're just the left coordinates versus the right coordinates. I actually defined them in the previous slide here. So T and Z in terms of epsilon bar and tau bar are defined over here, and the same way over there. Okay, so the usual thing is to now solve these equations for and get the Bogolubov transformations, get the coefficients, and when you do that, you find that they satisfy these relations here. And these relations are kind of special. They basically allow you to define a new set of modes. These are usually called the Unruh modes, which are just a very simple addition of these Rindler modes, but they have the nice feature that they are pure positive frequency functions of Minkowski time. And this means that these Unruh modes are going to share the Minkowski vacuum state. So in other words, the annihilation operator for these guys, which is this here, that annihilates the Minkowski vacuum. And since these Unruh mode annihilation operators can be written just in terms of a simple, a simple combination of Rindler annihilation and creation operators, well, then I can put them together and I can get a relation that must be satisfied for these Rindler creation and annihilation operators on the Minkowski vacuum. So what does this say? This basically just says that the number of right Rindler particles in the Minkowski vacuum is the same as the number of left Rindler particles in the Minkowski vacuum. Yes, this is still,
But you can do the same thing for Rindler.
Sure. Okay. And from this relation, you can sort of infer the general form of the Minkowski vacuum in terms of the Rindler vacuum. So in terms of the vacuum of these Rindler quanta that I defined, and it's clearly entangled here. So the big effect of this is that if I decide to trace out over the left Rindler mode, I get a thermal state. So I'm tracing out over this. It's blacked out. And this is what I get for the Minkowski vacuum restricted to the right Rindler wedge. And it's a thermal state if I interpret this bit here as a temperature. And, of course, the standard argument is that this thing is really hard to observe because 1 degree Kelvin corresponds to an acceleration of 10 to the 20 meters per second squared. So it hasn't really been observed to the present day. Now what I want to do is I want to use this argument, analogous argument, sort of a symmetrical argument, for massless fields. So in the previous case, I already took massless fields just because those are the simplest ones to write down. But it's actually important for this time-like entanglement that we have massless fields because the commutator vanishes between past and future regions as well. And so this same argument applies. We can treat them as independent subsystems. And so it's possible to describe it as the vacuum as an entangled state. And if you might be wondering, well, how do we know that we have massless fields? What if a photon, for example, had some really tiny mass? It's not exactly zero. Well, that's certainly possible, but the commutator is bound by m squared. So if you want to argue that the mass is really, really tiny but non-zero, then there should be some sort of approximation that you can go into and for all intents and purposes, assume that the commutator is real. Similarly, you can argue that maybe if you introduce interacting fields, then the vacuum wouldn't be completely transparent, and it might introduce a really tiny non-zero term on the right-hand side. But again, you should be able to go into some limit where they're effectively independent systems. Okay, so now what I want to do is argue that, okay, so these Rindler modes were defined such that if I define a Rindler mode in here, it doesn't do anything over here. And if I define a Rindler mode over here, it doesn't do anything over here. They don't propagate into each other's territory. But I didn't really say anything about if these Rindler modes could propagate here, or if these Rindler modes could propagate here. And in fact, they do. You can and you can see the intuition for this is I built these Rindler modes out of purely left-moving modes, plane waves. And so if I define some big superposition of plane waves here, well, of course, then they ought to evolve to the left and evolve up here into the future. And of course, these guys here, built of all left-moving modes, should have evolved from this region P, the past. So, so there should be some set of modes then that correspond exactly to, you know, if I create one Rindler mode in here, then that corresponds to creating a future mode up there. And if I created some Rindler mode in the left region, then I created some past mode. So I'll figure out what are these modes. So I can define the these new set of coordinates. I'll just call these conformal coordinates for the future and past in a completely analogous way to the right and left regions, except for now the time-like coordinate is eta, the space-like coordinate is zeta. And moving along, so for a constant zeta, moving along eta just actually turns out to be an inertial trajectory, just a straight line in this future region, and the same way in the past region, just a bunch of straight lines that all converge at t equals 0, x equals 0 here in the center. And in 1 plus 1d, the wave equation takes the same very simple form, and so the modes, once again, they look like plane wave solutions, except for plane waves in these new coordinates, which I define there. So these things are very analogous to the Rindler modes. Actually, they're more than analogous. They really are the Rindler modes in disguise, as I'll argue here. Okay, so the left-hand side of this slide are the Rindler modes, and the right-hand slide are the future and past conformal modes. Okay, so you can see they take the same functional form in terms of their argument, chi and nu. And here's what chi and nu are. Here are the Minkowski plane waves. Those are just obviously the same for both cases. V is the light cone coordinate. So this is important. The light cone coordinate here has the same functional relationship to chi as it has to nu in this case. And so therefore, when I write down these equations where I expand these Rindler modes in terms of these plane wave modes, well, actually, these equations are really quite identical. And so when I solve them for the alphas and betas, it turns out that all the alphas and betas are going to be the same. So essentially, this new coordinate system and these new modes are just discovering what I was talking about before. I mean, these are the modes that correspond in the future and past to the Rindler modes. They're exactly the same modes. They're the same combination of Minkowski plane waves creates both of them. Okay, so just to follow the chain of logic here, okay, so I have the same Bogolyubov coefficients there, and they have the same feature, satisfy the same relationship to each other. And therefore, I can define the Unruh modes in terms of the future and past conformal modes, just like I did before with the Rindler modes. And therefore, I have this same relation between the creation and annihilation operators on the Minkowski vacuum. And therefore, the Minkowski vacuum takes the same form in terms of these conformal modes as it does in terms of the Rindler modes. So it's just an exact symmetry that goes through. So this T thing here, that's actually the Rindler vacuum. It's the same vacuum state. But I just put a T there because if I put R in there, that you could interpret that as right or left in terms of instead of Rindler. Pardon? I forget what function or form it takes. It's just some. It's just a constant that you can cook up from omega I and A and something like this. I forget what it is, but it's a. You can find it in a standard text. Okay, so now, whereas before I had tracing out the left Rindler wedge left me in a thermal state in the right Rindler wedge, I can do the same trick here for the future and the past. So I have this complete set of modes up here, which still describe everything up here, but the whole Minkowski vacuum, when I trace out these past guys, once again I'm in a thermal state of these conformal modes. And as you can see, it's exactly symmetrical. Here, A, which was just a parameter in the coordinate system, it turned out you could interpret that as an acceleration. And here, A will also have an interpretation in terms of the detector, which I will now introduce. Okay, so that was just the field picture. This is now the detector. So I want to argue that you can actually see a thermal state if I build a detector which is designed to evolve in this conformal time coordinate, which is related to the ordinary Minkowski coordinate in this way. So basically, I want to write down a free Schrodinger equation for the detector. It's just going to have a two-state detector, and it has a certain energy gap. But I want the gap to represent. So I mean, this thing just has two eigenstates, and so defining this thing looks just like the Schrodinger equation in T. But if I actually then coordinate transform it back to Minkowski time, I get this 1 over AT factor here. So what this is telling me is that this detector, which I want to define to be analogous to a regular Unruh DeWitt detector, actually has an energy gap which is scaled in time. So down close to T equals 0, the energy is infinite, and then it eventually goes down to 0 in the future. Okay.
Trivially, with respect to the conformal time.
Yes, right.
So when you said inertial, you really mean it follows an inertial path, but its time coordinate is a little screwy.
Yes.
So you can correct for that by changing the energy gap.
Yes. That's another interpretation. Yeah. So ordinarily in the Unruh
case, you don't have to change the detector at all, but the fact that it's moving on this accelerated trajectory means that the time effectively will be scaled by time dilation. And so you get the same sort of effect happening. But in this case, we're talking about an inertial detector that just starts out at T equals 0 and just evolves into the future. But since we don't have any, since there's no acceleration or anything going on, we have to physically scale the energy gap. Okay. And then you can add in the interaction term. Just take the ordinary Unruh DeWitt interaction term, you add it in there. And then in eta, it actually picks up this little exponential factor just due to the change of coordinates. And then when you write down the resulting the detector response function, you get a new factor here, which wasn't there before. This is just the two-point function for the field. Here's the phase, and this guy ordinarily isn't there. The other thing that's different is eta equals infinity corresponds to t equals infinity, but eta equals minus infinity corresponds to t equals 0, right? If you just look up here, you can see what that means. So this corresponds to a detector which is scaled in time, but it's started out at t equals 0 and evolving into the future. Okay, and now I want to look at the symmetry between the case of an accelerating detector and this one that I've defined here. And here's what the two-point function looks like along this inertial trajectory. Here's what it looks like along an accelerated trajectory. As a function of tau, this one as a function of eta. And you can see that they have the same functional relationship except for, once again, this this exponential factor here. But the exponential factor has an overall minus sign, which actually kills this guy, cancels here. And so you get identically the same exact detector response function in the two cases. So once again, there's an exact symmetry, which means that if you actually solve this integral through the standard techniques in Brell and Davies or wherever, you get a thermal response. And in this case, in the accelerated case, A was interpreted as the acceleration. But in this case, A is interpreted as the scaling factor in the Hamiltonian. So A is the rate at which the energy is changing in this detector. And because just through dimensional arguments, you can see that A has units of 1 over T. And so this temperature actually is a factor of C larger than the temperature for the in the UNRWA case. So 1 degree, instead of corresponding to an acceleration of 10 to the 20th meters per second square, well, it's 100 gigahertz. Okay. One thing I should say is that back in the 70s and 80s, what people looked at, actually, they did look at what the field would be like in the future region here, but they didn't consider what it was like in the past. So they actually had these modes, which were defined up there, but they just defined the vacuum as, operating, or the vacuum was just defined in the future region only. It wasn't defined in the past. And so, therefore, there was no entanglement. The state was completely pure up there. But in this case, because we have to define, the vacuum has to be defined on the future and the past, that's the reason we get entanglement. So here is the way we're going to see the entanglement really explicitly, by sort of pulling this time-like entanglement out of the vacuum and turning it into entanglement between two of these detectors. So we have one detector. Actually, we have two detectors, and at t equals minus infinity, they're both just in the ground state. They're just, the state is 0, 0. And then, as they evolve forward in time, one of them turns on in this region, and then turns off. So these chi's here are not the coordinate chi's. Those chi's are the switching function. So it goes, when chi is 0, that just means that there's no interaction. When chi equals 1, that means that it's the detector is fully on. So anyway, one of them comes on in the past and then turns off. And then in the future region, another one comes on and then turns off. And then we ask the question, well, at t equals infinity at a constant time, is the state of these two guys entangled? Is the state non-separable? And we'll find that the answer is yes. This, I should mention that this was actually done, this sort of model was actually already done for the space-like case by Resnick, Retzer, and Silman. So they showed how to sort of extract entanglement in the space-like case, but then we're sort of using the same techniques to extract it from time-like separated region. Okay, so it's a standard kind of perturbation theory calculation. It's going up to enlightening. But at t equals infinity, you trace out over the field degrees of freedom, and then you get a mixed state for the two detector, describing the two detectors at infinity. And then to determine if they're actually entangled at t equals infinity, you look for the negativity to be greater than 0. That is the negativity calculated from here to lowest order, and it corresponds to just a simple integral that you can do. Well, simple, I don't know. It corresponds to an integral. And it turns out that, yes, you do get a positive value for the negativity, showing that you can get entanglement in this case. If you take these window functions just to be simple Gaussian, so they just kind of switch on and then they switch off in this nice smooth way. However, the next question to ask is, what happens if they're not symmetrically located across time? So this guy is on at around eta equals zero, eta bar equals zero, so that corresponds to t equals to negative one. And this guy, if x is equal to zero, that corresponds to him being on at t equals plus one. But of course, I can move this window function farther into the future or back into the past. And so this is a graph of the negativity, or a constant times the negativity, if I do that. And it turns out that, as I was saying, if I take the if I take x to be zero or very close to zero, then the detectors are non-separable at t equals infinity. But if I move too far away into the future or into the past, then I lose entanglement. So effectively, what this means is that the past detector has already come on and gone off at eta equals zero. And then I want to pick the time at which the future guy is going to come on. And so if this guy was on at a quarter to 12, then if I want to be able to extract entanglement, the future guy has to come on at a quarter after 12. And if I go too far into the future, if I come on at 12:30, well, then I'm not going to extract any entanglement. Similarly, if I come on at 12 o'clock, then I'm not going to extract any entanglement either. Nothing. It's just that's just the t equals zero in that graph, right? I mean, the entire problem can be just translated.
It shows up in the scaling of the detector. So 12 o'clock would be where the detector energy gap blows up, basically.
Another feature that this little scheme has is that I can extract entanglement in this little model for arbitrarily time-like separated regions. So I can go as far as I want in the past and as far as I want in the future. But the price to be paid is that the detectors have to be on for much longer if they're separated by a long interval in time. So here's three different window functions graphed in Minkowski time t, not the conformal time. This is just the ordinary stopwatch time t, about t equals zero. So this is t equals zero here. So and all three of these window functions give identical entanglement. So if the time difference is very small, then they don't have to be on for very long at all. That just corresponds to the blue peaks there. They're just very thin and sharp, and that pulls out a certain amount of entanglement. If I want to go farther away, so this guy is peaked farther out in time, then, of course, these things have to be on for actually an exponentially longer time. The total volume of this curve is much, much larger. So there is a price to be paid for moving farther and farther apart in time, but it's, in principle, it's completely symmetrical. Okay, so the next question is, okay, so we've got this entanglement. It can actually be transformed into ordinary entanglement through this process. Well, what can we do with it? And so we haven't shown any sort of new quantum technology schemes or something using this. But it does give you some kind of interesting, sort of a novel way of looking at quantum teleportation. So if you use this entanglement between this past region and the future region as a resource to do quantum teleportation, then you get this thing that it kind of looks like teleportation in time. Okay, so what does this graph mean? This thing that looks like an equal sign that's just supposed to represent a qubit. It's a two-level system described by Psi. And I want to teleport it up here into the future. So since the resource I want to use is the entanglement in the field, I need some sort of detector to come on and then turn off here and become entangled with the field in the way that I described before. So I have a qubit here that actually will be kind of entangled with another guy up in the future, even though the future guy hasn't done anything yet. This guy doesn't even really exist up here yet, but he's just interacted with the field. And then I do the standard teleportation stuff. I interact this two-level detector with the qubit that I wish to teleport, and then I perform a projective measurement on both of them. So then this qubit then effectively has been destroyed at this time, along with the state of this detector. All I have is classical information after that happens. Yeah, that's true. The field still propagates out away, but then I can't really get to it because it's propagating away.
Okay. So you could say that the field is
still there, but what I mean is that this qubit has been projected. It's been destroyed. So all I have access to. So like as Nick was saying, there's still these correlations hidden in the field, which is what we're going to take advantage of. But all I have in my hand at this point, after I perform a projective measurement, is just some classical information. And in order to extract entanglement from the vacuum to use as the resource here, I have to actually wait this same amount of time, as I was saying before. It's symmetrical across t equals zero here. So if this is, you know, an hour or something, then that means that for this length of time, I can't recover this qubit. It's disappeared. But if I turn on my future detector now at the appropriate time and then turn it off, then I will have the other half of the entangled pair, and then I can use this classical information that I got from this projective measurement here, I can then apply a unitary to the detector, and then out comes the state psi, which I wanted to teleport into the future. So this is a kind of teleportation in time. So I can recover the state psi, but there's a time in the middle where it's basically gone. There's no way to get at it. We haven't gone into the details of how to do this, like how much entanglement you need, because our model there, we don't know how ideal it is for extracting the entanglement. Yeah, sure. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you can always do distillation. Yeah, and so we just assume that this can also probably be done there, and that's probably what we'll look at in the near future is how to do this. But in principle, this is the basic idea. If you want to use time-like entanglement as a resource to do teleportation, then you wind up with this sort of interesting feature that looks in some way kind of like a time machine or something. Something disappears for a while, and then it comes back.
And a forward time machine.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so these are easy direction of time problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it is interesting that the qubit is actually gone. I mean, you have to wait around.
It's not really gone, right? I mean, because
it's in the field.
Yeah, it's right. I mean, so you've hit the vacuum with this weird detector that that clipped, and so I mean, if you look at the regular, Minkowski coordinates, it's going to look like the vacuum is no longer a vacuum. There's lots and lots of quanta that are doing something strange, and eventually you collect them again and you have another weird detector and you get out again. It's not that it's gone. It's just, I mean, presumably if you did some different thing altogether, you could get it back earlier, right?
Right. Yeah. Like maybe if you had detectors out here which are looking at the vacuum or something, this travels out at a 45-degree angle, and those guys sort of collect the influence that your detector had on the vacuum.
So you can do it on a local measurement.
Yeah. If you have guys out here, it's possible you could sort of reconstruct it. But then, of course, then they're going to have to send a signal back, and then you can collect it at a later time. So, so it only looks like a time machine if you're just sort of locally standing there, I guess, is what you could say. Right, it's a very loose definition of a time machine. But anyway, it seems like kind of an interesting thing. And presumably you could apply this to other stuff as well, but this is the only one I've really thought of because it makes for interesting discussion. These are the papers that are associated with this research. So that's it.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, so maybe you can comment some on the kind of conceptual basis of the mathematics you're doing. So in particular, what does it mean to trace out this past wedge?
Oh, yeah. I understand in the Rilke case, but...
Yeah. Oh, that's a good question. I should have mentioned it. Yeah, so let me go back to the picture here. Yeah, so down here... what does it mean to trace this out? Well, basically, it just means that this detector isn't on prior to this. Because if he's not on prior to this, anything that you do to the vacuum down here, he's going to propagate out at a 45-degree angle because photons travel at 45-degree angle. So therefore, this detector here will never see the effect of any changes to the state down here. So that means it's effectively traced out.
But I mean, I guess it's kind of stronger than that, saying, not to say it's not on, because that could be done with this windowing function, but kind of it does exist. Which in your case, I guess, kind of makes sense because this function blows up, that's specifying the detector.
Yeah, right, the energy gap of the detector
right.
Blows up here.
I don't know if there's any difference.
That it's not on and that it doesn't exist?
Functionally, I don't think there's any difference.
Well, I mean, so the underlying problem that is confusing me is that normally when we think about, you know, Hilbert spaces and so on, we don't talk about the past and the future as being a tensor product.
Right.
The Hilbert space is not a tensor product of the past and the future, right? We look at time-like slices,
space-like slices.
And,
But still, I mean, these are independent systems, right? I mean, you can specify the state here, and that has nothing to do with the state right here, right?
They're not independent systems.
Okay, yeah. I mean, the field commutes for these regions. I mean, I can do whatever I want to the field here, and nothing I do to the field there will ever propagate into this region up here. It all stays out.
Because you're focusing specifically on these left moving modes.
Oh, no. I mean, I could in general...
Right.
I can have the
masses not interacting.
Okay, maybe you should draw that picture that we had in my office with the Hilbert space.
Yeah, okay. Well,
I mean, if you want, I thought it would help.
Right, well, I mean, it's. I don't know if it would help it yet. But anyway, the. I certainly can specify the state of the field in here, right? And that's what, if I define a global state, then it certainly will define what the field is doing in this region. But whatever the field is doing in this region, it will never be, it will never propagate into this region. So that's sort of the identical reasoning here. It's whatever I change, I mean, if I can, you know, change the state in there in whatever way that I want, and that effect can only at most propagate on 45-degree lines, and none of it ever leaks into the right region. So that's exactly what happens here. I can change the state, I can perturb it, I can, you know, do whatever, and the effect never propagates up here. I mean, if I put mirrors out here, something like that, then the state could propagate there and then be reflected in here. And then you would get, the commutator wouldn't be exactly zero anymore. So then they would be dependent, but of course it wouldn't really be the Minkowski vacuum anymore because I would have set up different boundary conditions.
Can you explain this thing with the C again? What is the temperature? Are you just calling it temperature? It's not.
Pardon? Explain me.
What is this T?
Oh, the temperature. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, in this case, so this is a non-controversial or less controversial case. It's just, this is just the, n is the number of Rindler particles that are observed in here. Omega is the frequency with respect to that tau variable. And A is the acceleration of a, well, actually it's a parameter in the coordinate system at this point, but it turns out you can interpret it as the atom acceleration. Mm-hmm. So what people did was they just noted that, hey, this thing looks like a thermal state if I identify this particular combination of quantities as a temperature. Mm-hmm. Then I have E to the minus omega over T. And so this is one simple derivation of the Unruh effect in which you don't introduce detectors or anything like that. It's just the fact that if I trace out this region, then this what's left in this region appears to be a thermal state. So similarly, this exact same argument goes through in this case.
What omega is?
Omega now in this case is a frequency with respect to that conformal time coordinate that I defined. That eta.
But is it a time coordinate or is it a space coordinate?
Yeah, it's a timeline coordinate for me.
So I don't understand the units. That's the problem.
Okay. There's a C missing in the one below, so the units work out. A is not an acceleration.
That's what you were getting at, the factor of C difference. Oh, okay, yes.
And the one is actually correct. It's got C in the top and not on the bottom one.
So what? All right, so how do I interpret A now?
A is interpreted as a... in this case, it's interpreted as an acceleration. In this case, it's interpreted as a scaling of the energy gap of the detector. So I have a detector which has an infinite energy gap close to t equals zero, and then it just dies out as time evolves forward.
You can also think of it as the scaling of the proper time for a detector. I mean, this inertial trajectory isn't really a geodesic because it's parameterized incorrectly. It's parameterized with this screwy variable eta here. And that's what, so it has an ordinary energy with respect to eta. And if you could make a detector whose local clock ticked off 1 second in eta, then it would see, and they had a detector that also had that, then it would see that temperature.
Yeah.
This is the way to
get the same effect.
So is there any hope that you can get the same effect non-relativistically?
Non-relativistically. What do you mean exactly?
Well, just go back to the slide. I mean, one Unruh effect, there's no way, I mean, there's no hope that you could see this in non-relativistic quantum mechanics.
Because the temperature is too high.
In this case, maybe you could. I don't know.
Oh, so you're just asking if it's experimentally closer to the... Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so it looks like since the parameter seems to be more reasonable. I mean, it's still...
What is A?
It's still going to be tough. A is, for 1 degree Kelvin, it corresponds to something like 100 gigahertz.
Right. So you can do modulation on that, right? On that level.
You can do what?
Modulation of the energy gap on that level.
Yeah, so it may be possible, but I don't know the current state of the art with this in quantum optics or something. So
I mean, people are also actually hoping to see something like the Unruh effect and Hawking radiation in systems with sound waves.
Right.
That's
yeah.
The horizons for the speed of sound.
Yeah, sure. So that's an analog system.
Yeah, but I understand because the temperature doesn't depend on the speed. It doesn't depend on the maximum velocity at all. Maybe this could be something non-relativistic.
Well, yeah, I mean, the experiment, you don't have to move or anything yet. You don't have to, I mean, you can just do the experiment on the tabletop, right? Assuming that you're, assuming that you don't impose any boundary conditions on the field, which would screw up the vacuum at short distances or something like that. But in principle, yeah, you just do the experiment locally, and since it's just an inertial trajectory, it's just sitting there. So all you got to do is scale the energy levels correctly. And then,
I'm saying, take it one step further. As a theorist, could you derive this from non-relativistic quantum mechanics?
Oh, I mean,
picking up some situation that's similar to this. In certain ways.
So how do you get a non-relativistic field with zero mass? So they're kind of automatically relativistic.
Well, wait a second.
But you're saying the mass just has to be small, right?
Yeah, right, yeah, right. So it could be, yeah. So yeah, you could, if you can define an approximation where, yeah, the mass can be neglected, then it's possible. Yeah, I mean, there are many ways you can do it with this. I mean, this is just sort of a low order truth about nature, which is what I'm trying to get across here. But of course, it can be messed with in any number of ways. I mean, I haven't even begun to look at all the ways you could take this.
So Jay and I have already proposed a scheme to simulate an expanding universe.
Yeah.
By modulating the energy gap of a detector in a trapped ion system. And so in that case, we're using ions that are sitting there. I mean, they're not moving at all. They're the most non-relativistic that you could possibly get. And yet we're simulating a relativistic effect by modulating the energy gap. So, I mean, it depends on exactly what you mean by non-relativistic. Do you want an actual field? If so, would you take an effective field like photons in a crystal or a fluid? In which case, all of the atoms behave non-relativistically, and yet you end up with relativity with respect to a speed of sound being the maximal propagation velocity. So there's a bunch of ways to do this, but the crucial point is that the effect can be tested right now with a single atom just by changing its energy gap, and you'll see that it has a
or at least the spectrum. Yeah, right. It'll have the thermal spectrum. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's two effects: the thermal effect and the entanglement.
And the entanglement. That's right. So just the thermal effect you can see just in a laboratory.
Yeah.
Any other questions? All right. Well, let's thank Jay again.